Hello and welcome to the podcast, 10 Lessons It Took Us 50 Years to Learn, where we dispense wisdom, not just information or mere fact, to an international audience of rising leaders. My name is Duff Watkins and I'm your host. This podcast is sponsored by the Professional Development Forum, which helps young professionals of any age accelerate their performance in the modern workforce. Today, you'll hear honest, practical advice that you cannot find in a textbook because it took 50 years to learn this stuff. Today's guest is Gary Brown. Gary, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks, Scott.
Gary, let me make it clear to you, you're on the show today not because you're a member of the Order of Australia for your philanthropic work, not because for 20 years you were the CEO of a $300 million company, not because you wrote this book, brand new, which, by the way, I haven't finished because it's not that it's so thick, Gary. It's just that I'm taking all these notes and annotations, so it's very engaging and so quite stimulating, but I will finish it. Not because of that. You're here today on the show, Gary, because when you were the boss, you walked away from a $30 million opportunity to represent a very popular brand because you didn't like the way that brand represented themselves to the consumer. Not quite an authentic kind of representation, and you didn't want to be associated with that. So I thought, the guy that turns down $30 million, that's the kind of guy we want on this show, Gary. So, oh, and can I just point out, 4 years later, that brand spent millions and is no longer around. So, Gary, my first question for you today, think back. Do you remember your very first business lesson?
Duff, probably the first business lesson was not at that moment in time. It was probably some period of time after where I'd been working in the UK and I had an absolutely horrible boss who really made my life difficult. But I realized he made many other people's life very difficult. And to me, it was the fact that he was a bad manager. He wasn't a leader. He was a bad manager. And if anything, it taught me what you needed to do to be a good manager. The lessons that I didn't learn from him were the lessons I took away to really implement to be a good manager. So I saw that as being my first real lesson, because you learn good management and good leadership from bad management and bad leadership.
Learning what not to do is pretty crucial. And I don't know if I told you this before. If I'm running a seminar or something, I'll ask people, how many of you have ever had a good boss? And, you know, maybe one or two hands will go up. Then I'll ask, how many of you have ever had a bad boss? And people usually raise both hands, you know, to accurately. Yeah. So it's very common. But you can learn so much from a bad boss, as you're saying. What about unlearning? Is there something that you've unlearned? In other words, something you absolutely positively knew to be true at one time, but now realize is not the case?
So I think when we're younger and coming into a position, whether it in business or in professional life, where you aspire to be the boss or the leader, and you, let's say it takes you a few years, but you start to realize that the boss is not the one that's making the real decisions. The real decisions are made by your customer. And so if anything, when I was studying and learning management theory, it was all very much about the boss and top down. When in fact, it's bottom up. It's an upside down pyramid. The consumer decides whether you are going to survive, whether you're going to succeed. The boss is there, the leader is there to facilitate a positive outcome. And so I quickly learned that you really need to recognize that the consumer and the customer pays your bills. The boss may facilitate, but does not decide what the consumer will buy.
That reminds me of a story. I used to know this guy who worked for Mars, big Mars factory, and they make pet food. And they had this new super duper cat food that they put all this R&D to it, all the marketing, got the can right, got the look right, and it went nowhere. It didn't sell, didn't do anything despite all the input they put into it. So of course they investigate. They say, what's the problem? Why isn't this product moving? Why isn't this product selling? Answer came back, cats don't like it. just that simple sometimes, you know.
Yeah. Like,
but I think your message is we forget that sometimes.
We do. The consumer pays the bills.
Mm. Yeah, I like the way you said the consumer, the customer is the one paying your salary, not the company.
Correct. Correct.
All right. Let us start with your 10 lessons. Number one, you can't do it on your own.
So I think very simply, you get to a point when you are put in a management position where you actually want to prove that you can do it. But you really need to think that because the organization and the role you've got, there's no way you can do it on your own. You really need to have a good, solid team around you. And it's one thing to have people around, but it's having good people. Mm-hmm. But you have to be able to bring those people together, harness them in a way that is going to allow them to maximize the opportunity that may exist in the business. Mm-hmm. So to believe you can do it by yourself is just, it's not going to happen. You have to do it collectively with a team of people and believe that you can lead them, engage them, enroll them, and inspire them to the outcome that you aspire to achieve.
Leading, inspiring, that takes a lot of effort.
It does take a lot of effort, but when you practice something often enough, it becomes second nature.
Mm-hmm.
It's about working with people, dealing with people, and engaging them in a way that's going to have them follow you as a leader. If you look at the non-for-profit segment, it's a different dynamic. People are there as volunteers. They're not there to be paid. People need to be inspired and they need to be engaged to follow. And that's very much the same in business, except people are being paid. The dynamics are different, but the philosophy is the same.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this. Delegation, as you know, I run a lot of accelerated performance, call it coaching programs for senior executives. And delegation is an issue that breaks or makes an organization. And so many times I've seen it, and they tell me, they delegate stuff to people. And because they're trying to avoid the very thing you're saying, Gary, you know, trying to do it all on your own, trying to think that you're the superhero, that everything comes down to you. So they delegate it just as they're supposed to do, but it doesn't happen. It doesn't get done. The person they delegate it to lets them down. What do you do then?
Well, I think there are two elements there, Duff. Firstly, is it delegation or abdication? And if you delegate, then you have to have the key elements of educating, training, and developing those people so they are able to accept the delegated responsibility. Because it's not good enough to say, I'm empowering or delegating people to do the job if they don't know how to do it. Mm-hmm. So it's actually inspiring those people and recognizing that they have to come along with you. They mm-hmm. have to be part of the team. They have to have the similar mindset to you. So it's important that you check in, that you come back to them to be able to ensure that they can accept the delegation.
Mm. You use the phrase, and maybe it's from your book, but enrolling the support of others. And I like that phrase because enrolling, it's like, you know, you got to sign up, you got to subscribe to it, and it's on an ongoing basis. And as you pointed out, it is completely, utterly voluntary. And I don't know if a statistic that I bandy about a lot, 40% of a person's effort at job is discretionary. In other words, I work for you, Gary, I come in, I punch the clock, 60% of my job I do because it's required them there. The other 40% pretty much depends on you. Can you elicit from me? Can you educe from me the support, the effort, the exertion, the intelligence, whatever I may possess? And that's the leader or the manager or the boss's task as I see it.
I totally agree with you. And I think that I used to hear people say to me that people don't leave leaders, they leave companies.
Mm-hmm.
And if you are wedded to and committed to the leader, that the leader gives you the recognition, the reward, and ensures that you are enjoying and getting satisfaction from your job, then you're going to stay. Mm-hmm. And you're going to maintain that engagement with the leader and do the best you can to deliver what you are all mandated to do.
Psychic income, it's called. You know, people tend to stay where places where they're valued and appreciated. And the funny thing about it, best thing of all, it doesn't cost anything to appreciate somebody.
The only cost is the energy and effort that the leader puts into the people. Mm-hmm. And that should be absolutely everything, because people make and break organizations. Mm-hmm. Without people, you don't have an organization.
Okay, point number two, Gary, this must be a mistake, must be a misprint. Point number two, lesson number two, learn to be vulnerable. Now, obviously, Gary, I'm male and no one must ever discover that I don't know something. So please explain this to me.
You know, if you build up a facade in such a way that no one feels as if they can get close to you or be engaged with you, you are going to have a very frosty relationship with the people around you. Mm-hmm. You are going to appear to be not the sort of person who you can confide in, can work with, and engage with. And these sort of elements were something that I experienced when I was working in Belgium, in fact. And I had a very courageous boss. And I say courageous because his actual background was he fought in the war. This is going back a few years, and he was in the Air Force. And so if you think about it, in the military, they are ruthless, they're rigid. And when he came out, he saw a lot of people who really he didn't want to grow up like him. And so he took me under his wing and he said, listen, you appear to have a chip on your shoulder. You are not being able to express yourself in a way that I can feel I can work with you. And he said, if you can't do that, you're not going to be a good leader and you're not going to be able to bring the troops along with you. And from that day on, he made me realize how important it was for me to have confidence in myself and articulate my weaknesses. Mm-hmm. As we've seen in more recent days, when leaders stand up and say, I've made a mistake, that's being vulnerable. That's accepting the fact that we are human, we are not perfect, and that we all make mistakes. And so that's the vulnerability aspect that is critically important. And if you can't be able to communicate that in a positive way, then you're not going to be able to communicate and articulate to your team to get them to do the tough yards that are so common when times are tough. And when times are tough, we all have to get together and believe we're in the same boat and we're rowing the same direction to be able to survive and succeed.
Mm-hmm. Now, why do we even need to discuss this? I mean, everybody knows that they're vulnerable. Well, they may pretend otherwise. My own view is this is a particularly male thing about needing to appear invincible.
I don't agree with you. I reckon it's a human trait. Some of us do it badly. Some of us recognize we need to do it better. Mm-hmm. And so it doesn't matter what gender it is. We perceive that it is more of a male than a female. We do see that in terms of mental illness and suicide. There's definitely that element is where you see it more male focused. But by the same token, at the end of the day, we're all human beings and we all are vulnerable in our own way. Some express ourselves, some protect ourselves better than others.
You know, actually, your comment reminded me of something Marcus Aurelius wrote centuries ago. He, the emperor of Rome, but he was also a battlefield leader. He said, you know, you're a soldier. You're storming a wall. You get injured. You need help. You call out for help. Where is the shame in that? Where is the loss of face in that? When you need help, ask for it.
Exactly. We have been conditioned. Society has conditioned us to act and react in certain ways, and unfortunately, it is not allowing us to be in a lot of instances, the best person we could be. We are constrained by the perceptions and societal pressures. That is where we run into trouble.
societal pressures to do what, or to appear?
To behave and act in certain ways. And so we tend to navigate accordingly. And so it is positive and it is negative. And some people don't know the difference. You have to be courageous and be able to know that you can stand out from the crowd and be confident that what you are doing in terms of this vulnerability, that that is something that you are confident to articulate and you are prepared for everything that comes your way.
Mm-hmm. It does require courage. I mean, and the funny thing is, I mean, it's bleeding, obviously, everyone else around you, how your vulnerabilities, your limitations, your deficiencies. I mean, it's no secret. So, I mean, it makes you wonder why we bother to hide it from ourselves in the first place. But it does take courage to face it. But as I like to say to people, it takes this much courage and not this much. It's not that hard, really.
But people don't necessarily learn courage. They're not given the opportunity to be courageous. We tend to mix up the difference between risk as opposed to courage and actually taking that step. Once you've taken that step, you build more confidence to be able to go forward further.
Okay. Lesson number three, to be the fastest doesn't mean you're the winner.
Correct. And in my younger days, I was a marathon runner, an athlete, and I was always taught that if you're going to win a race, you've got to be the fastest, or whether it be the highest or the longest. That is not the case in life. In life, it's all about finishing a project, finishing together. Again, it comes back to this point of you cannot be a loner. You have to be a team player. And it's about bringing everyone along with you, not you finishing ahead of the rest. Mm-hmm. Because at the end of the day, as we said earlier, a business is made up of people and a team finishes together, not necessarily the boss or leader ahead of everyone else. They're the catalyst and the facilitator to the outcome.
Mm. I like to remind people, in business, it's always we, not I, not you, it's we. It's always going to be we. It also reminded me of something you were saying about Robert Louis Stevenson, the author, said it's better to travel expectantly than to arrive. In other words, it's the journey and enjoying the journey, enjoying the going and the doing.
Smelling the roses on the way.
Okay. Point number four. Now, you're going to have to help me out here. Reputation. It's yours to lose. Now, what do you mean by that?
Reputation is really your persona and who you are. If you lose it, as Arthur Ashe said, you lose everything. And it is your brand. It is what people see you as an individual, for what you do, the way you behave, the way you act. It is critical if you want to get ahead in business, in family, in life generally. People who have a reputation, and whether it be good or bad, that is what they're known for. And so when we're talking about reputation in business and you want to progress and develop, you've got to be recognized and understood what your reputation is and what you stand for. Lose it and you are lost as an individual.
Okay, let me see. I'm in the contrarian view. I think people pay far, far too much attention to what other people think and how they regard them. And a lot of those perceptions, as you know, and you talk about this extensively in your book, by the way, so I'm sort of cutting to the chase here. A lot of what people perceive is simply inaccurate, incorrect, false. I mean, even stupid. So how much is a person to be governed by those false, inaccurate impressions of them? I mean, if you have a reputation that is simply not steeped in reality, that reputation exists and has its own life, so to speak, its own power, but it's still not you.
Correct. And let's get a little bit more detailed and talk about what your purpose is. Because if you know what your purpose is, then that, to some extent, should be aligned to your reputation. Because your purpose in life and your values and everything you stand for are all wrapped up in your reputation. So your reputation, when you talk about perception, people's perception of you is not necessarily going to change when you know what your purpose, what your values are, and your reputation. People can throw stones at you, but if you are standing firm on your purpose, your values, you will certainly deflect those stones.
Okay, there is a cost to managing that reputation. I in the intro, I used the example of that $30 million opportunity you passed by. That would have been a big hit to the, a big boost to the profit, to the bottom line of a business, even though the business was successful. I should point out the business had its up and downs, of course, and like all businesses do in the course of your long association with them. And it was a very, the company itself is a, your former company or your current company is 136 years old. So it's weathered some storms, that's for sure.
Sure.
But maintaining a reputation. Okay, well, I'm what I'm getting at you is I see people obsessed with image. Now, maybe that's not the same thing as what you're talking about with reputation, but they seem to, in my view, invest way too much time, mental energy, life force in maintaining this image, which is just that, an image, not an image of reality, not the reality itself. How does that tie in with what you're saying about reputation?
Let me put it to you another way. You've heard that some people have substance, not style, or style and not substance. We're talking about substance of the individual. The reputation is not only just who the person is, their values, it's the way they behave. It's the way they act. Image is a perception of a belief. It's not necessarily reality in terms of the individual. And so from that perspective, image is quite different. The image that people project as opposed to the reputation of what that person is can be different. And it can relate to the environment in which they're in, the circles in which they find themselves, the people in which they associate with. But at the end of the day, the reputation is everything that an individual has that is theirs, that no one can take away. They can't take away who you are, but you can lose it by doing stupid things.
And lose it fast too, as we've seen every day in the newspapers, online.
I was thinking this morning before this session that when you look at criminals tend to get the best lawyer in town, whether they can afford it or not, but they want to be associated with the best lawyer in town because that potentially is going to show that maybe they're not as bad as they are.
So they mitigate their appearance by appearing with somebody, well, the best lawyer's money can buy. All right. Okay. Proceeding then to lesson number 5, disrupt yourself and your business.
So I could start at the with something that I was told many years ago, and that was that the quote of Sidney Meier, who started the Meier Stores, contentment is the first sign of decay. And the one thing I've learned very clearly is disruption is something that you have to continually be vigilant of. And one has to look at reinventing oneself, of innovating, of looking for new ways to do things. Because the day you stop looking for new ways and new ideas and new approaches is the day that you actually start dying. And so you really have to have a good, strong mindset that looks at new ways and innovative ways to live your life better, continually refresh your relationships. It's got to be part of your DNA, because if it's not, it's going to be such hard work and it's going to make life incredibly difficult. If there's anything we've seen in more recent times, especially in COVID, is the fact that people talk about doing things differently. And I've always believed you needed to stand out from the crowd to be able to be noticed. And when you are noticed, you've got the opportunity of taking on and doing things differently. And that in itself is about positioning your brand ahead of where everyone else is, because you are noticed. But it's also about reinventing yourself and the organization in which you're in. So disruption, it's the buzzword, I guess, today, but you know, it's reinvention of everything you do, whether it's in your work, business, play, whatever.
I think one of the things I find intriguing about your comment is that initiating the disruption, don't just sit there and wait for the next pandemic or the next change in the business world, but to actually engage, to initiate it within yourself, as a person, but also within your business. I mean, and you're quite right. I mean, for example, when I moved to Australia 40 years ago, IBM was they sold big mainframe computers. Now they sell consulting services of all kinds and descriptions of I don't even know. And they're pretty good at it from what I'm told, but it's a very different company than what it was before. The company you work for, 136 years old, I mean, they kind of do the same thing that they did years ago, but they do it a lot differently and a lot with very different products, I believe.
Yeah, very much so. And so reinventing our portfolio, our profile, the methodology, the name is there, but it's quite a different business now mm-hmm. than what it was many years ago. Mm-hmm. There's a common theme, and that is about building brands. And, you know, it's about trying to keep looking for new ways, new approaches. And the markets change incredibly over that period of time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Environment changes, governments change, consumer tastes change. You've got to continually adapt.
Well, adapt or die is the evolutionary motto, and it's just as true of business and of people. Well, I mean, maybe people don't die, but they decay, as you were quoting Sidney Meier earlier, Meier being a very large, important yep. department store in Australia. Speaking of change, I like this next lesson, lesson number 6. Change the people or change the people.
Yeah, and that's if you take it in the cold, hard statement, it looks uncaring and not sensitive. But at the end of the day, the most important thing to do is to try and educate, develop, and highlight to the people how important it is to reinvent yourself, to disrupt the marketplace, to be ahead of the pack in the market. Now, if those people can't recognize that and can't undertake that new initiative, then you have no choice but to change the people. So change the people or change the people. And as a result, what you see is a lot of people recognizing that they need to change but human nature is such that they're very comfortable with the status quo. And as we've seen in more recent times with COVID, you can't afford to be that way anymore. You've actually got to change.
Yeah, what status quo? But you know what you're saying is it's a very hard lesson. I mean, it is, because in my experience, and I've been on the giving and the receiving end of firings and being let go. Both, by the way, were equally traumatic. But it's a very hard lesson to learn, because you have to learn as a boss, as a manager, as a company, as a person, you have to learn to think very objectively, very critically, not in a negative way, but in critical thinking, I mean, and take it just a ruthlessly, with a Zen-like detachment, that kind of perspective to solving, say, a business problem or a life problem. That takes a kind of mental, emotional discipline that takes a while to acquire, in my experience.
Absolutely right. And we've all been in this situation, and it is, the one thing is, it never gets easier. You probably get more efficient at the way in which you are dealing with it, but it never gets easy, because you're dealing with humanity mm-hmm. and you're dealing with livelihoods. And that to me is a very important part of life and business, etc., is to ensure that people are looked after, even if the environment has changed to the extent it has.
Do you reckon most people will make the transition from status quo to the new status quo? You reckon most people will go along with you on that trip if you help them, show them, support them, show them how to get there, show them what to do?
In the main, that is the case. I think it is even more prominent now after COVID. Mm-hmm. It's because the environment outside, a lot of people are in denial of what's going on around them. They mm-hmm. just think about the security blanket is the company or the organization, and nothing's going to change for me. Everything will be the same. But I think what COVID has done is allowed organisations and society generally to recognise that nothing is sacred anymore, nothing is safe, and nothing is secure. And you need to be able to recognise that and not only adapt, you actually have to be proactive to find a way to get through those steps to ensure success for the future.
That is so true. I'm sure you know it as well. I know CFOs who have been, who's saying right now, I've been saying for years, why do we need that office space in that other city? Why do we need to take those flights overseas? You know, I've seen your executives tell me I can accomplish just as much through Zoom and email as I have before. Why do we need to go to, why do we need that office to go to?
Correct. Very much so.
Lesson number seven, loyalty and competency need to be in balance.
So that's always a challenge, Duff, and we're talking about humanity in the last lesson, but having really loyal, supportive people in the organisation is one thing. Having competent, capable individuals in the organisation is another. And it really needs to be in balance. You need to have competency and loyalty aligned, because on either ends of the spectrum, they are bad for the organisation, bad for the culture, and cause a lopsidedness that really does not allow an organisation to have a sustainable future. Mm-hmm. Because if people don't have competency and they're loyal, you're not going to have a business going forward. Mm-hmm. An organisation that's totally competent and not loyal, then it becomes transactional and it'll drive itself into the ground. So it really needs to be in balance. And so from a lot of the experience I've had in organizations where we've had to make serious changes, trying to work through the process of ensuring that those individuals that are remaining, if we've done restructures and reshaping, that the loyalty and competency of the individual is in balance. Mm-hmm. You know, we've had... whether it be in corporate change, structural changes, tax changes, whether it be GST or, you know, when Y2K was around, that's 20 years ago, or whether it was some form of computer implementation that didn't go right. All these things damage the business in some way. And so you need to make decisions that really allow for the organisation going forward. As I said earlier, it's important to make sure that those people are looked after in such a way that if the organisation changes and they find themselves without a role, that it's recognised and ensured that they are looked after they've left the organisation. And we always attempt to ensure that that occurred. Mm-hmm. And I like to use the words of speed and sensitivity in resolving these issues so that people can get on with their lives.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so why do so many politicians, so many professional coaches, so many business leaders surround themselves with people who they say are loyal to them? How many times have I read that? Oh, I'm so sick of reading it. Loyalty. Oh, loyalty.
Absolutely.
Why does that keep happening?
You know, I think it lacks the confidence and courage of people in leadership positions to accept that there should be diversity of views and diversity of opinions. Whenever I was employing senior executives, the one thing that was critical to me, that from a perspective of, apart from their capability, competency, etc., was the fact they were going to challenge me. If I wasn't going to be challenged in the issues and topics that I was for the business, then I most will not have had them around, because mm-hmm. I most will have done it myself. And so I always had people around who I encouraged to challenge me, recognizing that we would come to a conclusion that there is a way forward. Mm-hmm. I didn't always have the right answer. They didn't always have the right answer, but collectively we would have a solution and a decision that would take the business to the next level. Mm-hmm. And so I hated having what I called yes people around me. If I had yes people around, I suffer with people who are subservient. I can't cope with that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I don't know why, but it's something I've not been able to live with for many, many decades.
If the task of the senior management is to make the senior leader feel comfortable, I detect a business problem, you know, and whether it's politics or professional coaching, yep. or just, is there a method, Gary, that you can balance loyalty and competency in the people you work with?
Sorry, is there a method?
Yeah. You know, do you have any ways of doing that?
So I think that loyalty is usually built up over time. Competency can come into the business in a much shorter period of time. And it is about trying to bring diversity across the business. Now, there are some people who have loyalty and they did have competency at a point in time, mm-hmm. but they haven't been able to reinvent themselves and maintain their relevance mm-hmm. within the organization. On the other side of the coin, the competency individual is relevant because the business has changed. The question is, can loyalty be built up? Yes, it can. They don't always match. There is a timing difference in a lot of instances. But I think that they can be blended to a certain extent when you recognize that those with loyalty can move to a point of competency.
Mm-hmm.
It's about an assessment. It's about a continual review or continual monitoring to help those people get to that point. It is certainly needing clear focus when you have that as one of your mandates to bring them closer together.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point. I like that. Loyalty builds up over time. Competency can be injected at any time, but it has a use-by date as well. Just because you're competent at one time doesn't mean it's not an eternal thing. I mean, if you were the world's expert in the DOS system of computing back in the 60s or 70s, good for you,
doesn't
but
it,
you know, there's nobody who's interested in that anymore. So yes, competency is needs to be refurbished on an ongoing basis. Okay, point number 8, failure is part of life, so be prepared for it. It's coming.
Yeah, and if you haven't failed, then you haven't learned. I think very simply. And you know, we don't talk about failure that often. We talk about the fact of making a mistake and don't make the same mistake twice. But I think from my perspective, I was one who, and we talked about vulnerability earlier, I didn't like talking about my failures because that is a sign of what we were talking about earlier, of actually declaring your weakness.
Mm-hmm.
But if you can't talk about your failures, then you're not going to be able to talk about your successes either, because success comes from having made a mistake, because you actually have learned accordingly. And I guess in my situation, it doesn't matter how much you prepare to ensure you don't fail. There are extraneous circumstances and the environment will always bring you unstuck to some extent. It's about the degree of failure that you're prepared to tolerate or that your organization is prepared to tolerate.
Mm-hmm.
I can remember very clearly when I was a sales guy dealing with supermarkets, I was very keen on and passionate about making sure that I was able to get my product in on the shelf in the supermarket.
Mm-hmm.
And I pushed so hard and I kept getting rejections. And to the point that I was actually kicked out of the buyer's office. He literally told me, go away, I don't want to talk to you anymore. Don't come back. And it sort of recognize it hit home to me. And first I didn't understand because, you know, I was there to sell a product. And this brand, I thought he really needed because it hadn't been on the shelves. Put that aside, he really gave me the learning that I actually needed to recognize the buying signals.
Mm-hmm.
And recognize that he had a point of view and he didn't think I was appreciating his point of view.
Mm-hmm.
End of story. And so that was a really big failure. And I missed out on getting that order. I did go back some years later, and I was fortunate enough to get it in because it was a different buyer. But I learned a really good lesson out of that.
Mm-hmm.
I had other lessons as well where, you know, I secured a huge order and from another supermarket buyer, and then thought, I'm on my way. And then I get a call a day later saying, look, I don't think I can take it because I've got some competitive pressures, and we don't think we can fit it on the shelf, and your competitors come up with a better deal and all this sort of thing. In the end, I'd had a product, had secured a shipment of that product, and I was suffering. They were chocolate bars, and we had a Mount Everest of chocolate bars sitting in the warehouse. And it sort of made me very much aware that whilst you think you've got success, you actually haven't until it's actually delivered and the consumer's consuming it. And I didn't secure enough of the right documentation to lock that buyer in. I took him on his word, and you can't always do that.
Mm-hmm.
People change their minds. Circumstances change.
Well, three things come to mind, Gary. First of all, if you ever find yourself with a warehouse of excess chocolate, call me, okay? I mean, I'm your man. I can help you out there. I'll lighten your load considerably. The other thing is, what you're describing is a business situation, but it's really life. I mean, it's a live performance. I mean, you know, it's live and it's in 3D, and a lot of things can happen, some of which you have some control and influence over, but many, many, many things you got no control over, and it's
correct.
Live. And the other thing I like to say to people, it's jazz. It's not classical music where each note is orchestrated and you have creativity to play it, but it's not like that. That's classical music. Jazz is much more freewheeling and interactive. There's structure, absolutely structure there, but it's much more interactive. And that's kind of the way business and life is.
Yeah.
And the third thing I want to point out, because as I was reading my notes, you made me think of a friend of mine. I hadn't thought of him in decades. He was at one time the world super lightweight professional karate world champion. And he has some stories to tell. And usually the stories he would tell about getting kicked out of the ring or getting knocked through the ropes or how he lost this bout. And he said to me one time, and I've always remembered this, he said, oh man, you lose 8 times more than you win. And this is world champion, professional, super lightweight. And I don't know about the number, but I've always remembered that. It sounds about right to me. You lose 8 times more than you win. So you better get used to failing and losing, because that's on the menu for you.
Absolutely. Very much so. Very much so.
Number 9, this is one of my favorites, Gary. A job description is not a job prescription.
Correct. Doing your job within the parameters of your job description really is not enough. It may keep you relevant for a moment in time, but it certainly won't keep you in a sustainable role. And it really is a guideline. If you are going to be able to be relevant and you're going to be able to build your brand, you that I refer to, you actually need to step outside the square. And, you know, it's guardrails as opposed to handcuffs. Mm-hmm. And I like to put the guardrails there when we're talking about a job prescription, is that, you know, people have got to continually develop and be aware of what's going on around them. And it's about, in many ways, seeing what opportunities exist outside that job description. Because if you want to stick within the square and do nothing else, then that's fine. But that job ain't going to survive and be around in the long term, because life changes. Business moves on, life moves on.
Yeah, doing your job is a way to keep you employed temporarily. I like the way you put it elsewhere. It's about delivering an outcome, not just doing a job.
Correct.
And you talked about adding value to your internal customers as well as your external customers. Internal customer, the people you interact with inside the company or in your overseas subsidiaries. And it is a continual adding of value rather than simply mailing it in, punching the clock. As I was saying earlier about that 40% of discretionary effort. Now, you know, I could wait for you to educe it or elicit from me, Gary, if you're my boss, or I could get up my ass and start looking for ways so that I can contribute. I could show some initiative. And surprisingly enough, those are the people that tend to be promoted within organizations because they're so damn valuable.
Absolutely. And I take the view in not just business, but in any of the other sectors I work in non-for-profit or government, is that I'm there to serve. Whether you're there to serve a customer, whether you're internal or external, you're there to do a job. But at the end of the day, you're serving an organization. And that mindset, I think, is critical and will change people's approach to the way in which they actually look at what they do. But there are many people who actually don't like serving. So they're better off not being part of organizations anyway.
Yes, they're better in the back room doing what, and that's fine too, by the way. I mean, I often see, because you know, I do so many psychometric assessments of people, and some people, you know, they're meant for the front office and interacting with the public, and the people are more comfortable, better suited for the back room. So I say, let's get them sorted, get them where they're most productive.
Absolutely.
Point number 10, our final point. Message to Garcia. How did you do it, Gary? How did you manage to quote a book that not only have I not read, but I've never even heard of it? How can this be? Message to Garcia.
Look, it was a book that I was instructed I had to read.
Mm-hmm.
And I was given it very early in my career. I can't remember whether it certainly wasn't the first day, but it was certainly very early within the first couple of years. And it was a book that really changed the way I looked at or understood how work and life should be. Not that I didn't have a good work ethic. I think that's one of the things that really kept me in train. In fact, I probably took it to the nth degree. But it really was, I think it was 1899. It was a leadership book in America at the time. Mm-hmm. And I think that really what it did was it brought together everything that I saw within myself of being conscientious, taking initiative, looking for ways to actually do a job well. The problem was I took it to the extreme. But it helped me to set my expectations and my standards for myself, but also for those who were around me. Now, that had its ups and downs, and I had to tailor accordingly, because we're all human and we all make mistakes. But I think in the end, what it did was it really gave me a good grounding of how to be a good leader.
When you say you took it to an extreme and caused you problems, what do you mean by that?
I became too focused on trying to achieve and trying to do a job to the extreme. You know, I was out of balance. Mm-hmm. And I put my job at that stage at center of my life, as opposed to trying to balance out my life of having work, social, play, etc. That over time changed.
Thank you for sharing that. Ultimately, we all learn an essential existential lesson. It's just a job, man. You know, that's really what it comes down to. I mean, you know, and it's important, but you know, it's just a job at the end of the day.
You're absolutely right. On you, as someone said to me on your deathbed, they're not going to say to you, or you're not going to wish that you're going to want to have had another day's work before you drop dead.
Yeah, things you won't hear on your deathbed. I wish I spent more time at the office. I wish I accumulated more stuff. You know,
exactly.
Well, that book evidently is the one that had. And this is important. I want to emphasize this: deliver an outcome. Don't just do a job. Delivering an outcome is valuable. Delivering a job is that's pretty useful too for a while.
Yeah,
for a while.
Exactly right. Yeah, very much so.
We will finish here on this note. You've been listening to 10 Lessons It Took Me 50 Years to Learn. Today's episode is produced by Robert Hosfrey and is sponsored by the Professional Development Forum. Our guest today has been Gary Brown. The Professional Development Forum provides webinars, social media discussions, podcast parties, anything you want, everything you need. You can learn more about them online, professionaldevelopmentforum.org. And best of all, everything they offer is free. Thank you for listening to us today. We'll see you for the next episode of 10 Lessons It Took Me 50 Years to Learn.